This is a class in historical theology at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, Missouri, on Thursday, April 4th, 1968. Reverend Dr. Martin Charlemagne is speaking to us on ethics and war, some contemporary issues. Mr. Charlemagne.
Thank you very much. Karl Barth once said, "You theologians act as though the Great Commission read, 'Go into all the world and make a problem of everything I told you.'" This is not an issue of that kind. The ethics of warfare is not the kind of problem that you invent. It is a tenet. And I should like to discuss the particular problem today in depth. The source of the problem, its context, and then provide a few guidelines. But in hasten to add, there is no serious solution to this problem. This is the kind of problem in which each one has to make up his own mind on the basis of the best insights that he can acquire. Let us admit, first of all, that war is always a symbol of failure. The military goes to work in an attempt to apply force to a situation that has become insoluble in other ways. And when this happens, there's always great tragedy. A war is not a Sunday school Christmas, never has been and never will be. We realize this more today because no hostilities have ever been covered so thoroughly as Vietnam. The war has been brought right into our living rooms. We have colored photography to see what blood looks like when it comes out of a human being. The only thing that's really missing is the sense of warfare. This is still a little difficult to transmit over thousands of miles of ocean. But someday we will not have just television but also smell-o-vision. And let us hope that by that time there is no more war. We have no promise that this will not be the case, however, I should add. War being what it is, a pacifist will say that warfare and ethics are mutually exclusive. That even the title is a contradiction. That there is no such thing as the ethics of warfare. But I should like to suggest that this is a gross oversimplification of historical situation and of the elements and ingredients of our existence. Very often, especially in the Lutheran Church, pacifism has its source in a confusion between law and gospel. The absolute pacifist, for example, acts and talks as though a nation were run like a state, forgetting the fact that nations operate with power. The symbol of government is the sword, not the child. International relations are an arena for the manipulation of power. That just happens to be a fact. And when you have 127 sovereign nations working together in the world, each one insisting on its own policies and on its own interests and rights, you get an interplay of power. And it would be totally absurd to try to introduce into this arena of operation the principles of grace and mercy. This would be a confusion of the kingdom of God's left hand with his right hand, or the other way around. What we're supposed to do just now is to raise the question, which of course confronts us in the Fifth Commandment, and simply ask, is it ever right to kill a human being in battle? That's where the rubber hits the road, to quote one of my colleagues. That's the question which the soldier, the sailor, the airman in Vietnam and Laos has to ask himself and has to answer. So it is this question that we want to talk about in terms of its source, its context, and its solution.
Let's talk first of all about the source of the problem. It comes to us as a question of conscience. It is created in large part by our Western culture, with its heavy accent on the value of the individual life. There are many areas in the world where life is cheaper, where it has considerably less value than among us. We are the heirs and the benefactors of the Judeo-Christian tradition, and there has always been an emphasis on the value of the individual having been made in the image of God. During the long centuries of our history in the West, war has always posed a difficult moral decision. For the Jews of the first century before the Christian era, fighting in battle had become a matter of most serious scruple, and Julius Caesar had sense enough to find it expedient to issue a decree that they would be exempt from military service. Now, he could afford this kind of action because there were enough people of other races in the Roman Empire to make possible the defense of the long borders of the empire. From Jewish tradition, the question spilled over into the life of the early church. One of its earliest theologians, Tertullian, insisted that serving in the Roman army and being a Christian were incompatible with each other. However, we hasten to add that his most serious problem in that context was the responsibility of burning a piece of incense to the statue of Caesar. It was a question of idolatry, more than a violation of the Fifth Commandment, which troubled him. In the Middle Ages, various devices were created to limit the scope of fighting in battle. One such institution was called the Peace of God. It reduced to a minimum the number of people that were involved or engaged in any given conflict. That was followed by the Peace of God, which forbade fighting during certain times of the church year. All through Advent, through Lent, and from Saturday night to Monday morning. Then, as the number of holidays increased, the period for peace, or potential peace, also increased. But you know how men are. When they are restrained from doing certain things in this particular way, they will, and in this case did, take advantage of the open season to fight more ferociously than they would have had they been allowed to fight all year long. A little more than 100 years ago, our traditional interest in saving life, rather than destroying it, was officially written into what we call the Geneva Convention, 1864. This, by the way, is a very important document to know about. Three principles were spelled out in that document in order to reduce the number of casualties in warfare. First of all, it was stipulated that medical personnel were not to be considered as combatants. The convention also asked for a humane treatment of the wounded. That's the second point. And thirdly, it stressed the neutral status of civilians who voluntarily helped to take care of the wounded. Now, in the 60s of the last century, it was not difficult to draw a rather keen line between combatants and non-combatants. But when the airplane was invented, by which even the centers of cities were exposed to view, this line became very, very difficult to draw. First of all, of course, the airplane was used as an instrument of reconnaissance in World War I, and the only way that Paris could be shelled from a distance was by a gun known as Big Bertha, which lobbed huge shells into that city from 75 miles away. But by the time World War II came around, London and Berlin were both subjected to bombing from airplanes. And soon thereafter, our own continent was laid open to the possibility of invasion from the polar region. You see, up to that time, we had been living behind the ocean. No one could get at us except by ship, which is always more accurate than across land. But we are now exposed also over the North Pole. With these developments, the distinction between combatants and non-combatants really vanished. As a matter of fact, quite frequently, more civilians perished in warfare than people in uniform, simply because cities were and are bombed, and that's where people work, presumably in war factories. The development of nuclear energy has very obviously escalated this whole problem of warfare. John Foster Dulles wasn't engaging in any idle boast when he indicated that we had the power to reduce any enemy nation to a vast howling wilderness. We had enough destructive power in our arsenals at that time to drop the equivalent of 6 tons of TNT on every individual who lives on this tiny globe. That incidentally has risen to 20 tons of TNT today. The chief of staff of the Air Force, General McConnell, said in a speech in Detroit about 2 years ago that he could destroy all of Vietnam in 20 minutes if he wanted to, but he wants to live in a howling desert. For our present discussion, it is significant to note that as soon as Mr. Dulles, our Secretary of State at that time, uttered these words about massive retaliation that he used to talk about, the American people reacted rather vigorously against that kind of threat. Subsequent discussions of this principle revealed the presence of serious conscientious scruples on this issue and testified to the hope that our difficulties could be solved in less lethal ways. Under Kennedy then, in 1961, our whole strategy changed. We went back to conventional weapons for the purpose of fighting justifier wars, as we call them, rather than resorting to the instruments of massive nuclear retaliation. In the case of a nation which has had world leadership thrust upon it, we didn't ask for this, it is of more than passing significance that there should be this sensitivity about wholesale slaughter. Being a superpower, we could be arrogant and callous in our approach to other nations, and the extent to which we are a superpower perhaps often escapes us. We constitute 6% of the world's population, but control 60% of its resources. There is only one superpower today. The Soviet Union isn't even in their favor, their second running. But we still have a strong desire to exercise responsibility and even restraint. Why should we tie our hands behind our backs in South Vietnam, except for the fact that there is a deep running revulsion in our culture and in our society against excessive slaughter and damage? Our purpose in Vietnam is not to destroy North Vietnam. Our purpose is to demonstrate that it does not pay to undertake aggression against another nation. As a matter of fact, out of this sensitivity and out of this moral ingredient in our way of life, they developed under Secretary McNamara two principles under which we operate in warfare today, both of them reflecting this sensitivity. They are known as the principle of controlled response and of conventional action. Under the concept of controlled response, we keep reminding ourselves that we must avoid a hair-trigger approach to any major difficulties we have in keeping the enemies of our nation at a distance. Under the principle of controlled response, we've also prepared ourselves to ride out a nuclear attack. We said over and over again that we will not be the first to resort to these lethal weapons. We propose to fight back, of course, but we will not start such a holocaust. Furthermore, we have established a policy under this principle that we will attack only in terms of counter force, that is, against the military establishment of an enemy nation and not against its civilian centers. The second doctrine of the Secretary of Defense is known as that of conventional action. In keeping with this express policy, we propose never to be caught in the situation where the decision to employ tactical nuclear weapons is forced upon us. We are not about to resort to such weapons contempt or the feeling of being at bay. All this loose talk of recent months to the contrary notwithstanding, where people began to get suspicious that we might use tactical nuclear weapons in Vietnam. We will use them only as a matter of deliberate choice, if at all. I said all this in order to make one point, namely that in our culture, we view wholesale destruction, especially of life, as immoral. This view is the product of our Western conscience, shaped by the moral accents and emphases of Old Testament prophets and the teaching of the Christian religion. If we did not believe in life as a gift, and if we did not believe that the individual is of great value, the whole question of warfare would not pose much of a problem to us at all. But as it is, we think of having to fight in terms of anger, and that's rather reassuring, I would like to suggest. The very fact of the question testifies to the importance of life in the affairs of men. Randall Cannon didn't worry about this question. Joseph Stalin didn't when he exterminated millions of Kulaks. And the Red Chinese generals didn't worry about this as a moral issue when they left millions of people starve in China. Killing is not a problem for people who do not approach the question from our point of view, from our position of sensitivity toward human rights. Well, so much for the source of the question, not the context. And I should like to indicate that this is perhaps a very important aspect of the whole question at this moment. Is it ever right to take life in battle? We want to take up this particular question in the light of its context, because the problem doesn't come to us out of the blue. We confront it today within a given context which we can describe. It comes to us as a free people. It comes to us in a context where the question of freedom has become crucial. Now, in order to underline the nature of this context, let me start by a reference to an East German play, the first one to be shown on this side of the Iron Curtain. I happened to be in Paris in June of 1956, the day before the Gaulle took off for Moscow on his first trip, and had a chance to see this play by Eugène Ypres. It's known as The Dragon. And the story of the play is a very simple one. It's a fairy tale. In an unnamed country, a dragon has for years been in control of everything and everyone. And according to the plot, a knight errant comes dancing on the stage in order to free these people from the power of the dragon. But to his surprise, he discovers that nobody wants to be delivered. The people enjoy their servitude. They don't want to go to a way of life where you have to make decisions on your own. Now, this is a frightening parable. It is a master piece of irony in fable form. It reads in two dimensions. And on its face, it is a very simple tale that any child can understand. But when you read it at the second level, between the lines, this is a biting satire on the possibilities of a totalitarian system. One of the points that it makes is that man can be reduced to the level of an ant-hill society. He can be kept from being less than what his creator intended him to be. He can degenerate to the point where he no longer wants to make personal decisions. Incidentally, that's been one of the problems for people whom we have brought to this country from a totalitarian country. They are totally bewildered. And for a while, they're totally incapable of managing themselves because they've never had the opportunity nor the responsibility to make decisions for themselves. Now, the process of rejection takes time, but given enough time, the desire for free response may evaporate. And when that happens, an individual ceases to be a person. Then he is reduced to being the quotient of 1 million divided by 1 million, to quote Arthur Christie. Such distortion is the product of political and social forces which we can legitimately and properly call demonic. For whatever keeps a human being from being less than what his Creator intended for him to be, whatever distorts and destroys his life is demonic. Now we happen to live in the kind of age, and it's the first one in history, where it is actually possible with the instruments of modern technology to control even the thinking of people. Old madman Tiberius, even though he was a tyrant, could never accomplish this. But today, with the means of mass communication and the devices for manipulating men's souls, it is possible to take a man apart and put him together again according to your own presuppositions and principles. If you've ever met someone who has fled from the Iron Curtain, you will have been struck by this very helplessness and confusion when he discovers that whole segments of information have been deliberately blotted out, blocked out from his life. I remember a Jewish Lutheran pastor coming to Rome. He had fled from Romania. And when we were there in 1966, 2 years ago, he had lived in Romania, trying to take care of a Lutheran church in the capital city of Romania, and finally found it impossible to live there, and fled. He was still wondering, he wasn't so sure that there was still a Pope at the Vatican, because the Vatican was never mentioned in any news broadcast or in any literature that was available to him. And he was surprised at the wealth, the power of the Vatican. 20 years, basic information had been blocked out of his youth and experience. And so the individual becomes incapable of making intelligent choices, because the art of freedom is a difficult one and can be practiced only where you have access to the basic information of them. So in our present context, we face the question of moral principle in warfare on the awareness, and I should like to underline this, that nothing less then freedom is at stake. And of course, we in America have no conception of what it means to live in a totalitarian situation, except for those individuals who live there and fled from there. Imagine yourself in a system where everything not specifically commanded is forbidden. Then you have a totalitarian situation. I have an aunt living in East Germany, Rick Messenger, and had a chance to talk with her last summer about the degeneration, the distortion of life, that exists where you can never be sure you're doing the right thing unless it has been specifically commanded, where everything else is prohibited, and somebody can steal on you and you go to jail for it. Now, totalitarianism, of course, talks about freedom. Naturally, it's a good word, and a good word must be distorted. This is one of Lenin's basic principles, incidentally. There are two things he said we have to do to gain control of the world: distort language and debase tone. Totalitarian systems have the following definition of freedom. It is the responsibility of the individual to do what he must do. And how does he know what he must do? Well, the party tells him. This is its job. It has the task of analyzing the historical situation and then prescribing what needs to be done. And a man is free to do what he's told to do. That's the essence of freedom in a totalitarian society. And so the whole possibility of responsible choice is taken away. And that is another way of spelling out how an individual is kept from being less than what his Creator intended him to be. At this moment in history, The demonic forces which are at work in every society have become incarnate in the communist conspiracy against men as men. And I am always amazed at the degree of blindness that exists among Americans in not realizing that this is what the ideological conflict is all about. People who have experienced communism, like some of the South Koreans, they know what this means, to be engaged in a bitter struggle against a massive attempt to subvert and to distort everything that is human. The question of taking another man's life in battle comes to us in this particular context, and that of itself begins to offer us direction toward an acceptable solution. Freedom, as James Truffaut Adams wrote in his famous essay of 1938 on freedom when the Nazis were the chief threat, insisted that freedom is a religious issue, deriving its full dimension from the nature of man, from his need, and from his destiny. I want to make a prediction between these two paragraphs. We read a lot about the negotiations that are supposed to start now. Well, don't kid yourself. These are much overplayed. What are we going to talk about the bombing system? That's going to take about a year. Then maybe we'll get to some substantial issue, and that'll take another 2 years. We negotiated in Korea for 2 years and lost more men during that period than before. In fact, they didn't get down to serious business until we moved in a few missiles with nuclear warheads into Okinawa and said to the Chinese, okay, put the pressure on and we'll start talking. Well, they did, you see. Coming back now, don't kid yourself. There's nothing going on of particular significance in these negotiations yet. We hope it's a breakthrough, but this is part of the methodology of communism. It's written it in their text. The purpose of warfare is to get people to negotiate, and then we'll negotiate and fight at the same time, for however long the enemy wants to negotiate. You should see some of these people who try to negotiate in Korea. We've been at that for 50 years, you know. I was at the 172nd meeting of the Armistice Commission in Korea. This is something to behold. There is real animosity in history. Two ways of life talking past each other, refusing to understand each other. Well, this is what's going to happen in Vietnam. Well, coming back now to the issue of freedom. This is derived from the nature, the need, and the destiny of man. Man, you see, is not like a bar of gold. When a bar of gold sinks to the bottom of the ocean, it's out of circulation and useless. We never treat a human being that way in our society. In fact, we go to all kinds of effort and expense to recover the body of one GI lost in the swamps and rice paddies of South Vietnam. Even in death, we respect him. We will go to endless efforts to rescue people that have gone down in an airplane over the ocean or where a ship is in trouble. Because in our society, there is a feeling for the notion that man is God's creation, and therefore never useless. Think of the millions of dollars we spend on nursing homes. Why shouldn't we let these people die? They're useless to society. Well, we don't let them die because man is not a thing. He is by nature different. The concept of freedom relates also to man's needs. You cannot grow an oak tree like this idea in a 2 gallon pail. Either the pail will burst or the tree will die. Man has to have room to make choices. That's our notion of freedom. That's what we're fighting for. To continue a way of life and to extend it to others, giving them an opportunity, the elbow room, to make choices, because that's what it takes for a human being to be a person. And Dr. Epstein's stories, his book, of his experiences in Siberia. He was sent to Siberia because he was a liberal in his age and somehow got involved in the plot and the life of the Tsar. And so he was sent to this distant land, and he describes what, how life was like, what life was like. Everything was ordered. You got up when you were told to, you ate what was put before you, you put on the clothes that you had no choice there, not, nothing like two neckties to choose one from. Incidentally, this is one of the great handicaps of civilian life. You always have to choose ties. When you have a uniform, you don't have any choice to make. They went out and fell trees that had been marked by others. There was simply no choice to make, and the title of the book is very significant. The house of the dead. Of course people still walked around and fell trees, but as human beings they were dead because they did not have the opportunity to exercise choice. So in our society it is always insisted that freedom is my opportunity to do what I ought to be doing. Freedom is also related to the question of the destiny of man. And this, of course, is where our theology and the confirmation of the church becomes so factually important. If the individual lives for only 70 or 80 years, and that's the end of him, then the state which lasts 1,000 years is more important, and therefore can make a claim on him. Can say, look, I gave you the life that you have, I'll take them away. But if the life of the individual lies beyond the limits of our present existence, as we are sure it does, then the state, powerful and benevolent though it be, belongs to the order of things which pass away. Then the ultimate issues of life cannot be solved, have no right to be solved, either by the state or by the party. And so Jefferson could talk about unalienable rights that we have, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They come to us as human beings. Are part of our creation. No state gives them, no state therefore can take them away. Now, we spend a lot of time on this particular point because it happens to be such an important ingredient of the present context within which we confront the question about killing. We live at a time when the basic values of life are at stake on a universal scale, and don't let anybody kid you on that point. We are engaged in an effort to restrain and contain a conspiracy against everything that keeps life human. We have set out to keep specific demonic forces from succeeding in their attempt to distort and to degrade humanity. Now, having talked about the context, let's try to suggest a certain guideline for a solution to the question. First, let us remind ourselves that life is a gift. We are not an accident of the universe. Life is not our invention. It is not your achievement. It is a gift. It can be sacrificed. We think of a sergeant, for instance, who throws himself on a bomb to save his whole unit as having done something noble, as having taken his life and sacrificed it. The second point is that life is a gift to be defended, especially if it is the other fellow's life. You remember all the story that we had about a year ago, much longer than that, 2 years ago, when some girl was murdered in New York City, and nobody living in the apartment who knew about what was going on heard those things bothered. Well, there was a reaction to this. There was a general feeling that it was immoral not to have got involved to defend this innocent girl from the individual or individuals who were murdering her. Another example. If a thug came into my living room and threatened my family, my job would be to make a choice between my responsibility to my family, which in this case rank higher and in terms of life now, and my responsibility and my obligation toward the thug. Now here's a side of the question that often gets confused. The practice of love in an actual situation is often very complex and depends on an extra factor, namely justice. My relationship, for instance, to the combat soldier of North Vietnam is not a straight one-to-one relationship. Like the man who helped the good Samaritan who helped the man falling the mountain. It's not that kind of relationship. Because there are two things between them. My loyalty to my nation, which has priority, and his loyalty to his nation, which has priority to him. And so you get, in the actual situation of life, a hierarchy of values and responsibilities. And this is respected and implemented by using what we call justice, the distribution, the proper distribution of the responsibilities of love toward other people. In the instance of the thug in the living room, it would be immoral for me not to come to the defense of my family. That's the kind of responsibility I have toward the members of my family. And I'd like to suggest this is a pretty close analogy of what's going on in the world. There is a thug among the nations of the world. We must take a good look, however, at the commandment, thou shalt not kill. And this is an interesting experience all by itself, I forgot to suggest. The commandment, thou shalt not kill, is translated in the ISV, in the Feminine, you shall commit no murder. And that, of course, is the text translation. It is a very interesting commandment that this word for killing that occurs in the commandment is never used in the Old Testament for killing and warfare. There are two contexts where it never occurs in the Old Testament. One is warfare, and the other is in the context of a government going about its business as capital punishment. In that type of situation, this word does not occur. Because involved in this term is the thought of malice aforethought, of hatred. And there you will remember, of course, the words of the Lord, that the violation of this commandment is hatred. That's basic. Well, I am here as one to testify that it is possible to engage in warfare without personal hatred for anyone on the enemy side. Why? We don't like his system. The men may hate Charlie in the abstract in South Vietnam and aggregate. But one can fight, one can engage in combat without hatred, malice aforethought toward a particular human being. Furthermore, we have to remind ourselves that this commandment is not an absolute one. That is not so to be understood. God is always above the commandment. He asked Abraham to sacrifice his son. And that is no contradiction. Furthermore, in the Old Testament, there were cities of refuge to which you could go to try to determine whether a particular killing was homicide or murder. And if it was homicide, the reaction was different from that of murder. Remember how the Israelites were ordered to destroy the cities of enemy nations? Here again, God was making an exception. And from this, we derive the observation, the ethical observation, that an exception is made to this commandment in what we call a just war, in terms of our confession. An exception exists also in the instance of the living room incident, for sure, where it may be necessary to kill him in order to preserve the integrity and the health and life of the family. At work in the world today is a demonic force determined to frustrate and negate the will of the Creator. There is a diabolic conspiracy abroad to turn truth into a lie, freedom into tyranny, democracy into dictatorship. And this war is partly about the question of what will the future be? Will it be a utopia in reverse, or upside down? The kind that George Orwell describes in 1984 in his Animal Farm. You know, where the principles are painted on the barn. And what is it? The seventh one is family changed. All men are equal, except that some men are more equal than others. This kind of perversion. Can you imagine the horrors of a universal tyranny? Can you imagine what it would mean if all nations of the world were subject to the kind of totalitarianism that exists in Red China and the Soviet Union and a few other places? The prospect of a universal tyranny is a prospect so terrifying that it may well suggest we are seriously to reconsider the commandment, thou shalt not kill, as we have done. Asking ourselves whether this is not quite likely an instance of acceptance to this particular command. Now, it so happens that many millions of people live with hope in the world today, but they do so only because there is one nation, yes, strong enough to resist this conspiracy. It so happens that our interest in liberty, our open society, is the kind that they dream about. They would like to have it. And this, of course, is good for us in the long run within the present context. Because we don't usually have to impose our way of life. People would like to have it. They envy us at times for what we already enjoy. They would like this freedom, the opportunity to make choices, the basic choices in life. Is it right to take another man's life? That's the question we asked at the beginning. In summary, we might reply that there are conditions under which it becomes necessary to do so in the defense of a way of life that intends to keep the future open for mankind. We live in an age when such freedom is under full attack from a demonic conspiracy bent on perverting and distorting all of life. The present context, therefore, I would suggest, has created an exception to the principle set forth in the words of the commandment, thou shalt not kill, especially when you consider that the word killing here is the one permitted. Moreover, the blessings of liberty are such that it is worth the sacrifice of life to keep these benedictions for others. And this is a good Christian approach, but when the other fellow is threatened, when he has need, I have the job to get involved and be concerned. We are the only nation at the present time strong enough to engage successfully in this conflict. We didn't ask for this burden, but we have it. It is a tragic burden, admittedly, but we live with it. It is our responsibility. Thank you very much. We do have some time here, about, what, 7 minutes or so?
Yes, well, there is the microphone right there, and you want to carry it and stay right there.
Yes, I think the mic is there to take it down and tape. Is that right? Oh, okay, right behind you. Okay. Will you take it? Yeah. This is like a Connecticut convention. Good for that. Yes. Yeah, well, of course, he begins with a very optimistic basis, which is quite in keeping with our historical tradition. The founding fathers of our nation were much more optimistic about the perfectibility of mankind and human society than the scriptures, at least, would lead us to believe. This is where I think a re-study of Luther becomes very useful, especially on questions like to disorder and the susceptibility of the human situation. It was a wonderful dream, and we think we're possible. There are just too many things demonic, things working against it. And it is the demonic that he doesn't, that Skinner doesn't really take seriously. And that's in keeping with our, admittedly, our tradition. I don't want to be understood as saying there's a kind of monolithic apparatus from it. Monolithic. Separation apparatus, I have no question about this there. For example, when I was in the Philippines last year about this time, there was a petition circulating among the white missionaries that they were to sign asking President Johnson to stop the war in South Vietnam. Well, I said to them, have you ever asked yourself the question, who got this petition to you? Where did it come from? Who wrote it? And isn't it strange that it has the same wording as petitions in East Europe and South America? Who does all this? Like those student demonstrations we have all over this country, who works with this? If not an apparatus. I'm not saying it's a communist apparatus, but there is an apparatus if things don't just happen. That on a given Saturday you have demonstrations in 20 different areas of the U.S. at the same time. Who does this, if there is not communication and planning in between? Now, I don't want to be understood in the sense of a monolithic operator. What I'm trying to say is every communist trained in the principles of dialectical materialism has the exact reverse of understanding of reality that you and I have. Communism is a caricature of the Christian religion, and that's another speech which you don't want to hear now. Every principle of the Christian religion has been taken up into communism and distorted to visit. Just a simple illustration. Our eschatology is secularized and caricatured in communism. All this talk about the leap, you see, is the New Testament twinkling of the eye that St. Paul refers to. And behind it is the principle of the laboratory. If you reduce water down to 32 degrees Fahrenheit, you suddenly get something else by a leap, ice. So says the communists, we're regulating society in order to produce the equivalent of the 32 degrees Fahrenheit. So that by a leap, not gradually, we get the new order of things. Well, this is eschatology, you see. Read the second verse of the International. It's all eschatology. The whole world will be the Soviet Union. You see, the communist has an interpretation of history, which is a takeoff on the biblical notion of history, a line moving forward. That's why he's always optimistic, because this line moves forward and upward. The better thing. I'm sorry, that's not longer than I wanted it to be. Please. And just a depends on No, you have no notion of what it means to block out news. You have to live in a communist country. We always have our newspapers, and as long as the newspapers operate the way they do, and the TV and the radio media, you really don't have to worry about information being blocked out. It may come to us in a scary way, distorted. And then our job as responsible citizens is to try to straighten up the picture, because this is one of the jobs we have in a community society. Yes, the military presented one way because they had a certain purpose. But the newspaper people over there, we allow them to go there in order that we may have the information. I always get bothered by this. The people say they don't know what the war is about. Well, the Secretary of State just appeared before the Fulbright Commission and he talked for 10 hours, wasn't it? And he spelled it out completely, which would never happen in a closed system. One question. Second question. What the Communist Party wanted to accomplish, quickly turned off. The weapons were all on the other side. So when some literary authors get up and talk about this, they get jealous. Yeah, this is all part of the picture. Part of the adventure. Now, I don't want to deny that there isn't an evolution that takes place in the light of human love for liberty. I don't want to deny that. But I do want to say, the situation being what it is, there isn't really much opportunity to do anything because the weapons are all on the other side.
We have to go to the country, and anybody has to go, they're asking him to come forward. Dr. Rowe, they want to record it.
Yeah,
Vietnam, who knew how to do things, they wanted to stop
Yes, I think I understand that problem. You have the experience of coming in. You know what this is like. By the way, do you get CPM, control your theological answers? I don't usually refer to anything I write, but I did a little bit on the theology of communism and the racial issues. I'd like to recommend it to you. It's nothing along this line. It is your spelling out of what it means to have a completely different interpretation of reality, which every communist has. That's what makes him work the way he does. It makes him the threat to carry the truth. So, thanks very much.